little man, don't let them tell you that they have the plan. Welcome to Thinking Clearly, a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick, and I'm beaming in via Skype, as is the other host of this show, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hi, Bob.
We have a great guest for this episode of Thinking Clearly. But Julia, let's start out as we usually do by telling folks how they can get in touch with us, give us feedback on the show, and get our previously archived podcast versions of Thinking Clearly.
Yeah, absolutely. As I like to say, Bob and I are real people, even though we might be beaming in. We're still real people, and we like to hear from you, our listeners. You can find Thinking Clearly on Facebook. And lastly, we are podcasting. If you don't have the chance to catch us live, or maybe you want to go back through our archive, or just listen to me and Bob over and over and over again, you can find
over and over.
maybe you have insomnia. I don't know. You can just open up your podcast app on your device and add feed, search for new podcasts. You know, they're all a little different. And just put in Thinking Clearly. It should come right up. If you can't find it for some reason in your podcast app, you can visit directly at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. And that's Libsyn, L-I-B-S-Y-N. So that's thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. And you can find the entire archive of Thinking Clearly.
And Julia, because it will come up in our first question to our guest on this episode of Thinking Clearly, we're going to start by reviewing our working definition as well as the longer description of critical thinking. Let me do the first part, the working definition, and Julia, you can do the longer description. It starts like this. Critical thinking is a mode of thinking that uses the process of logical reasoning based on a thorough examination and evaluation of a robust cross-section of evidence relevant to the issue at hand when forming claims, conclusions, opinions, and beliefs.
Well, that's pretty succinct. That definitely conveys what critical thinking is. But of course, we have this longer definition. I haven't quite written our book yet, but we're getting there. Our longer description of critical thinking includes, critical thinking also includes an awareness of and attempt to compensate for the vulnerabilities we have in our thought processes, including cognitive biases such as confirmation bias. Critical thinking is most effective when there's a basic understanding of the scientific method, a certain minimum amount of basic literacy in the content areas related to the issues we are examining, and the willingness to be a lifelong learner. Lastly, when communicating our ideas using critical thinking, we're willing to acknowledge and evaluate evidence that may be contrary to our conclusions and consider alternative conclusions and beliefs.
Yeah, and those can kind of be called attitudes or predispositions that go along. And I'm sure we're going to find others, and we're going to check out how good our definition description is with a person who happens to be fairly much an expert and has written a book. And I'll tell you about that. But how would we frame the topic for tonight's show, Julia?
Well, I would say we're going to explore the essential knowledge about critical thinking, but also the kind of diverse perspectives. Because critical thinking, it's not, as our definition shows, a singular thing. So, yeah, we're going to be covering a lot of kind of essential aspects of critical thinking.
And our guest, Jonathan Haber, is an educational consultant. He's a researcher and a writer, working in the field of professional assessment, curriculum, and standards development, and educational technology. And his work on massive open online courses, those are called MOOCs, have been covered by the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and other publications, and was the subject of a book called MOOCs, The Essential Guide, and that's on MIT Press. And Jonathan was also the inaugural visiting fellow at Harvard X, And HarvardX is the program at Harvard that creates free online courses. There's a wealth of knowledge on those online courses. And Jonathan recently served as director of assessment for a new graduate school of education. He's currently working with companies and nonprofits on projects related to academic standards and critical thinking instruction. And his other books include The Critical Voter with the subtitle Using the Next Election to Make You and Your Kids Smarter. And his latest book that we're going to talk a lot about tonight is called Just Critical Thinking. Jonathan Haber, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thanks so much. I'm excited to be here.
I know Julia has a question to start us off.
All right. So as you may have heard at the start of the episode, we talk about our current working definition and description of critical thinking. It's definitely continued to evolve as we've done this show. And in your latest book, you discuss various definitions of critical thinking. Since ours is a work in progress, do you have any suggestions for us in how we might improve it going forward?
First, it's very solid. I like the fact that it includes the sort of technical aspects of critical thinking, you know, logic, evidence, argumentation, as well as in your sort of longer description, many of the human elements in terms of human psychology, dispositions, biases, and things. So I think you are, you know, well in a family of definitions of critical thinking, as was just mentioned. My book sort of takes on definitional issues related to critical thinking, because the new book, MIT Essentials Guide, is trying to make critical thinking, the concept, accessible to the average reader. So it's less a how-to guide. There are many very good textbooks, and you mentioned Critical Voter, another book I've written, which is more of a how-to guide. But this is more trying to understand where the whole concept of critical thinking came from and what we could do to increase the amount of it in the world. So in terms of definitions, I've had a kind of attitude where I think, you know, work like yours and definitions going back to the 40s and even the 1910s are very useful and informative and help move along the whole conversation. But they've also somewhat gotten in the way of the sort of critical thinking project, because I think there's a mistaken attitude that unless we can come up with a consensus wording for what critical thinking is, you know, a consensus definition, then we can't move forward because we don't know what critical thinking is, you know, well enough to teach it or build it into society. And I think that's incorrect. But I couldn't really sort of understand why, because I was struggling to synthesize all these definitions or come up with my own. But instead, I took a genealogical approach to critical thinking. I tried to find out exactly, you know, where did the concept originate, that there's a form of thinking unique enough to be called critical, right? It's distinct from intelligence and wisdom. And in fact, that's a contemporary concept or a 20th century concept. One would think it's very ancient because, you know, it taps into logic and rhetoric and language skills that go back to ancient Greeks. But in fact, you know, you can trace critical thinking to an origin point, 1910. That is when John Dewey, one of the 20th century's most important intellectual educators and pioneers, wrote the book How We Think. And in that book, he proposed the first definition of critical thinking, which is he referred to as reflective thinking. And I think, you know, all the definitions of critical thinking, including yours, have been in sort of dialogue with that ever since. And as I said, they all do important work definitionally, but I think fundamentally they all fit into a framework that indicates critical thinking really consists of three elements. Knowledge, you have to understand certain aspects, certain things, like logic, for example. But, you know, as you've talked about a lot on your show, you have to apply that. You have to be good at it. You have to have the skills, the critical thinking skills. And so skills are another important component. And then they have the dispositions to want to be able to do it. So I think all the sort of various wordings, they stress different elements, but I think fundamentally they all fit into a framework of knowledge, skills, and dispositions. And while the definitional work can continue, we can move forward with the critical thinking project, understanding that there is enough of a consensus framework to move ahead.
That's one of the things that I really appreciate about your book, is that a lot of books on critical thinking don't talk about the historical aspects of critical thinking, the connection with philosophy, and the education, you know, the achievements that have been done in terms of integrating critical thinking into the education in this country. And in that book, the recent book, Critical Thinking, you discuss the important critical thinker disposition, and you call these dispositions, of being open-minded. When I think about that, I think about open-mindedness is on a spectrum. On one end, the radical skeptic, who's a person that doesn't believe anything, to the completely credulous person who's willing to believe anything. And on this show, we talked a little bit about having a detection meter, a baloney detection kit. And that was Carl Sagan's term for it. And he talked about that in his classic book, The Demon-Haunted World. And the question is, John, how can we accurately detect clues in information that we're exposed to in order to do a proper kind of initial vetting of that information? When we look at information, what do we look for that strikes us as, this is something that I really need to look into more?
You know, I'm glad you started with the notion of open-mindedness being potentially a two-edged sword, right? It could lead you open-minded that you believe anything, but also you can become so, not just skeptical, but cynical that you believe nothing, even though the things that are true. I think, you know, one way to approach it, you mentioned sort of philosophy, and John Dewey was in a philosophical tradition called pragmatism, which was the kind of only major school of philosophy that originated in the United States. And elsewhere, I've made an argument that critical thinking itself is a sort of pragmatic concept. I won't dwell on it at this point, but it should point out that, you know, the person who sort of created pragmatic philosophy, a philosopher called Charles Sanders Peirce, talked about sort of open-mindedness, curiosity, but he talked about it in the context of what thinking is, right? Some people believe, you know, thinking is a divine spark, right? We are uniquely wired to reason. That's what sets us apart from other animals. There's all kinds of very theoretical aspects of what thinking is, but the pragmatist approach is that thinking is simply a means to an end, right? We think to dispel doubt. That's the reason we think. When we don't know something, you know, that explains curiosity, but it also explains the various ways we deal with curiosity, right? We encounter something that's strange, that's unknown, we have a doubt about it, and there are different ways we can use our mental facilities to get rid of that doubt, right? One of the things we could do is called a priori thinking. We just believe what we already believe. And you mentioned in your longer definition, confirmation bias, right? That's what that's all about. I could solve my doubt by just saying, I understand it because it's just an example of what I've already believed all my life. You can also dispel doubt by just having somebody else tell you what to think, right? That's called authority. You know, you could believe a priesthood, you could believe, you know, a leader, or maybe just norms of society. That dispels your doubt. Another way you could dispel doubt is to defy authority, right? To believe the opposite of what authority is telling you. That's called tenacity. And all three ways actually do the job, but none of them get you particularly closer to the truth, right? A lot of baloney can sort of enter your belief system if you believe everything from a priori cognitive confirmation bias, or believing what you're told, or resisting what you're told, right? If you want to get closer to the truth, you can dispel that belief through systematic reasoning. Peirce talked about sort of scientific reasoning, and John Dewey, when he created the concept of critical thinking, just said those systematic ways of reasoning can be applied to all disciplines, not just science. So I think in a way we could sort of take that open-mindedness not as a sort of trap we could potentially fall into and become, you know, either hyper-skeptical or kind of open to everything, whether it's true or not, but as a sort of a starting point. Think of the sort of curiosity and the open-mindedness of young children. And if, as they're growing up, as we're raising them, as they go to school, we can harness that natural curiosity, but channel it in productive directions, i.e. through the use of critical thinking skills, then we stand the chance of giving them the tools they need to be able to weed out good and bad information and understand strong versus weak reasoning.
I'm wondering, as I'm thinking about this, whether one thing that might help people, I know it's something that I do, is if I see something, some information, one of the things I'll do right at the start is I'll think of, what is my bias towards this? Is this something that I tend to agree with, or is this something I tend to not think is true or agree with? What's your recommendation there? Is it, do you think it's important to sort of recognize our biases right at the beginning of an analysis of the information that we're trying to do?
Absolutely. I think, you know, obviously if you're dealing with factual information, there's, you know, all kinds of ways to research the facts or the arguments. But I think, you know, one very important factor is to not just understand the potential biases of the source of information. That's what you get when you sort of follow sort of media literacy or information literacy principles. And that's an important, valuable thing to do, but also to understand the potential biases you are bringing to your analysis of that information. That doesn't mean we want to get sort of skeptical or cynical, you know, getting back to your last question about our own ability to understand anything, right? We are human beings, so therefore we have certain biases that we are prone to, and we're not going to eliminate them, but we can understand them, we can identify them. And once we understand and can identify them, then we can control for them, right? We can't eliminate and become utterly unbiased individuals, but we can recognize, oh, this is a subject that I have strong beliefs on, so I have to be extra careful to make sure I'm not vetting my factual information based on my beliefs. It doesn't necessarily mean that your beliefs are wrong or that, you know, they don't bring certain important values to your thinking process, but it just means you have to sort of recognize the strengths and weaknesses of your beliefs and make sure that you don't allow them to distort your judgment.
That's a great way of putting it. So one of our missions in doing this podcast is to explore the benefits of, you know, taking the extra time and that extra energy to learn and practice critical thinking. I really like the way you broke it down. That would be kind of like expanding our knowledge and developing and refining our skills and nurturing our dispositions. Are ways I would put it, you know, and they do take extra effort, you know, whether it's mental labor or just, you know, the conscientiousness of learning and practicing critical thinking. What are your thoughts about what makes that extra effort worthwhile?
You know, we've all made good and bad decisions by gut instinct or just sleeping on it, you know, but we've also made good and bad decisions by really putting the time and effort into thinking things through. And I'm guessing, just from our own personal experience, that we've had better luck when we've thought about something before we made a decision, right? The odds, even if they're only slightly in your favor, that you'll be more successful, that when you think about things than when you just sort of go by gut or fly by the seat of your pants. So, you know, if we stand a chance of being more successful, making better choices, you know, even if it's just a numbers game, why not do that more, right? Why not go with the technique that seems to lead to better outcomes? So that's a very sort of practical reasons to think critically. You know, you think about your personal decisions, your career decisions, decisions about where to go to school, where to send your kids to school. All these decisions, they just seem to, you know, I think if we inventory our lives, we find that they went better when we put the effort into thinking them through. Now, what critical thinking does is teach you to think these things through systematically and therefore more effectively. And so again, why not put in that extra effort? Because it's not like you're comparing it to the effort you put into by not thinking about stuff very hard, right? You have to compare it to all the effort you have to put into undoing the results of a bad decision. So I think, you know, just in terms of sheer kind of utilitarian payoff, thinking critically is of substantial value to everyone's life.
That sounds like decision making is really one of the important emphasis you have there.
And problem solving, you know, think of you know, decisions large and small, right? You know, what dishwasher to buy, but also, you know, whom should I marry? Should I take a job? You know, but also who should I vote for? Should I believe, you know, that, you know, this data coming in from one source about a pandemic, for example, you know, all that is the costs of poor choices are substantial, which is why the effort it needed to think things through well is small compared to the effort needed to rectify errors in judgment.
You know, as we think about this, the answers to that particular, which is, I think, a critically important question, because too many people don't do it. Too many people don't put that kind of energy and effort into vetting their information and checking it out, is what philosopher and creator of Critical Thinker Academy, Kevin De LaPlante, who I know, you reference him in your book. We've had him a couple times on this show, and I remember something that he said in one of his, I think it was before he even really started doing any kind of a podcast. He did a lot of different episodes on critical thinking, audio episodes. And he said that one of the important reasons to do critical thinking is to make your beliefs your own. You get a certain amount of ownership if you actually work those through to the point that you really have sought the evidence and done the thinking that it takes to ensure that those beliefs have a, you know, a truth value to them.
And Kevin had some real insight. I heard that show that he was on, one of the shows he was on with you guys. And, you know, but he talks about having reasons for your belief. That's what he really sees, that, you know, the point of critical thinking. And you know, this comes up when I'm talking about, like, election politics, for example. You know, I've got a book that we're talking about a little bit about sort of using election politics to hone your critical thinking skills. And some people, including, you know, sort of thinkers and philosophers I admire, say, well, you know, why would I do that? I know who I'm going to vote for, right? What's the point of putting energy and time into, you know, thinking about that even more? And I guess, you know, the answer I usually give, well, you know, even if you end up coming to the same conclusion you would have without reflecting, without reflection, even if you end up, you're going to vote for the same person, you're going to make the same decision, you're going to be on, you know, the side of a particular issue that you would have, you know, even without sort of going through the process of critically thinking about it. If you think critically about it, at least now you have reasons to explain why you are voting in a certain way or believe certain things. And those reasons can make your position stronger if you need to debate it, for example, or if you need to defend it. You know, there's a risk, obviously, is if you think critically about a subject that's important to you, you might be confronted with the fact that, you know, your beliefs are not well-founded and you need to really think things more. But for me, that seems like a source of intellectual strength, not weakness.
Jonathan, your background is in educational curriculum development and that sort of thing, so, and you've had a long-term involvement in that. Back in 2009, the Common Core State Standards were developed, and which include critical thinking, and they were drafted and then subsequently implemented in the majority of states in the U.S. And we did an early episode, I think it was number 6, on Thinking Clearly, on California's version of the Common Core, and motivated listeners can go back to our archive and listen to that to get that background. But can you give a brief update for us now on the Common Core State Standards project and talk about your vision for the future of public education teaching critical thinking?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, Common Core, as you said, it sort of came out in, you know, over a decade ago. And I think it was sort of 46 states adopted it. With some variation, there was sort of allowances if you wanted to sort of tinker with it up to, I think, 15%. But most states adopted it, and then many states will update their standards every, you know, five to 10 years. So I'd say in most states, the state standards either continue to be Common Core unchanged, but in more and more cases, you have states that have made some changes, sometimes small, sometimes significant. You've also had some states that abandoned Common Core. They didn't want to be part of it anymore. But I think a phenomena I noticed, because I was very involved with sort of creating free online versions of all 50 states and crosswalking them to a common compendium, is that even when states have sort of walked away from Common Core or never adopted Common Core, as they continue to update their standards, they are picking up elements of Common Core, like the sort of Common Core's kind of critical thinking content, which you see particularly, for instance, in the Common Core ELA standards in areas like speaking and listening skills or argumentative writing skills. And in mathematics, you've got the mathematical practice standards that are really sort of critical thinking standards. And I think, you know, the existence of these modern standards have brought on standards like the Next Generation Science standards or the C3 standards in social studies that are all much more infused with sort of critical thinking principles. And that's great. I mean, I think I was very enthused and excited that teachers who want to teach critical thinking skills, which is basically, you know, just about all of them, if you survey teachers or college professors, they'll say, you know, teaching kids to become critical thinkers is one of their top three priorities. You know, sort of 90 to 99% of them will tell you that. I think what's been missing is, you know, simply having a standard that articulates a critical thinking principle is sort of, that's a good starting point. But unless there are pedagogies associated with how you teach critical thinking, then that teachers are thoroughly trained in, then they're going to, you know, have the aspiration to teach critical thinking. They may even think they're doing it well, but they are may not be doing it effectively. The statistic I like to use is that even though 99% of teachers and college professors say teaching kids to become critical thinkers is top priority, and most of them believe they're doing it well, 75% of employers say the graduates they hire after 12, 16 or more years of college, they say those students don't have those skills. So it doesn't mean the enthusiasm's not there. That's why I consider the glass is half full, right? Teachers are excited about getting their kids to be prepared and skilled critical thinkers, but they may not be using the right approach. And about 20 years ago, there was a critical thinking researcher, Dr. Ennis, who proposed three different approaches to teaching critical thinking. One is called a general approach, where you teach critical thinking basically as a standalone course. And that's how we teach critical thinking at the college level. At least in the U.S., there's a critical thinking course, not across the board, not in all schools, but certainly in California, for example, the state schools don't just have critical thinking courses, but it's required for graduation. But there's also two ways you can teach critical thinking by kind of making it part of the teaching of other subjects, English, math, science, et cetera. One is through a method called immersion. And immersion basically incorporates critical thinking into the teaching of other subject matter, but does it without being explicit that you're learning critical thinking skills, right? And this is the technique we use primarily in K-12. You have smart teachers teaching complex material, and they just assume that critical thinking comes along for the ride. And it turns out that is the least effective way to teach critical thinking because, surprise, surprise, if you want students to learn something, you should teach them it explicitly, right? Just because, you know, physics is so wrapped up with mathematics, nobody would say, well, why do we bother teaching mathematics? Let's just teach them physics and they'll learn math, you know, through osmosis. But that's kind of how we teach critical thinking, right? We are teaching English or math to the Common Core standards, and we're assuming that, you know, well, critical thinking skills are there in the standards, teachers are committed to it, you know, let's just it's going to just happen, you know. And whereas an infusion method, which is the one that has proven to be the most effective, you make the teaching of critical thinking skills explicit. The example I like to use is the math teacher who's teaching geometric proofs. So geometric proofs are a textbook example of deductive reasoning, right? But how many math teachers stop and say, okay, that proof we just learned, that's an example of deductive reasoning. Let me tell you what deductive reasoning is. Okay, and let's compare that to inductive reasoning, which is the primary form of reasoning used in science, and the science teacher can pick up inductive reasoning when they're talking about critical thinking skills in science class. So that's what infusion would look like, and that's how the skills seem to be most effectively taught. So I think, you know, there's a gap. There's not an enthusiasm gap. There's not a gap in the standards. There's a gap in the sort of technique and the pedagogy. And a lot of my work since finishing the book for MIT was to create what I call a set of high leverage critical thinking practices that kind of bridge that gap between kind of knowing what it is we need students to learn, understanding that the best way of teaching it is to incorporate it into the teaching of other subject matter. So the high leverage practices are there to show you how to do that. What are the pedagogical techniques that allow you to do that?
Part of the problem I see with giving a course, maybe in college or whatever, for critical thinking is that people learn it in the class, but then it doesn't really get integrated into their real life habits sometimes. And my hope in starting at very early grades is that it then is repeated all through school, and repeated again K through 12, and then repeated again in college or university courses, then it inherently becomes hopefully a part of our habitual way of analyzing and looking at and absorbing information into our opinions and beliefs.
Yeah, you couldn't be more right. I think, you know, I mean, it's great that critical thinking is taught in the college level. You know, I think the professors who are doing that are, you know, doing great work, but you know, by the time kids get to college age, you know, they may not have had the opportunity to practice. They may not understand the skills they're supposed to be good at. And, you know, I think it's potentially, you know, there's one researcher who says, you know, becoming a skilled critical thinker is like becoming a skilled musician, you know, or athlete. It takes 10,000 hours of practice. And while, you know, that might be an exaggeration, even if it takes like half that, even if it takes, you know, some number of thousands of hours of practice, right? One college course is not going to prepare students to be able to do that. Nor, in fact, would, you know, any amount of critical thinking instruction you get in school. What you need to do is instruct people how to do it, but also inspire them to do it on their own by, for instance, showing them how they can end up making better life decisions if they know how their critical thinking skills. And that inspiration will create, you know, what I call a virtuous cycle, right? The more benefit you see in your life by thinking systematically and reasonably, the more you'll want to do it. The more you want to do it, the more practice you'll get at it. The more practice you get at it, the better you are at it, and the more you'll use it, and so on and so on. So, but I couldn't agree more that, you know, starting at an early age and providing lots and lots of opportunities for students to be exposed and re-exposed to it and given lots of opportunities to practice. I think that's at the heart of the sort of high leverage practices, is to take things that students are already going to be learning English and math for, and science and probably social studies subjects for 12 years in school. You know, why not make the teaching of those subjects an opportunity to learn critical thinking skills, especially since if you approach those subjects through a lens of critical thinking, you actually learn the content better, as well as developing this valuable life skill.
Yeah, and it also makes me think that university students, generally speaking, are eligible to be voters in the United States, which brings me to my next question. It would help if they got that critical thinking skills before they went to the ballot box. You know, we are coming up on a very important presidential election, or at least I hope we are. And folks might benefit from checking out your book, Critical Voter, And I see that you also have a new online project at logiccheck.net. Could you explain how that works?
Sure. Yeah. No, I think I mentioned before that the recent MIT book is on critical thinking is not really a how-to guide. It's more about how do we educate for critical thinking? What is it? You know, how do we incorporate it into kind of various aspects of life, et cetera. But Critical Voter was more of a how-to guide. It taught logic and language skills and diagrammatic reasoning and all the things you covered many times in your show. But it used presidential politics as sort of a case study to provide examples of each of those concepts. So it really wasn't so much a like, you know, here's how you could decide who to vote for using these critical thinking principles. It was more using the shared experience of a presidential election to learn about practical critical thinking skills, right? Because candidates are making arguments all the time. They're making arguments in campaign ads, they're making political speeches. You know, our life is sort of surrounded by arguments and things we can analyze with a critical thinking toolkit. And with Logic Check, I sort of continued that, but Logic Check is a little bit different in that it is based on the fact-checking sites that have become very popular over the last 10 or 20 years, the sort of factcheck.org and PolitiFact, which I think are doing terrific work, and I think they're very valuable. But there was a philosopher, Gary Gutting, who sadly passed away last year, but he wrote a lot for the New York Times. He was a Notre Dame philosopher. And he pointed out that facts, as important as they are simply the premises in an argument. And in many cases, the facts could be perfectly accurate, but the argument they fit into leads to a false conclusion. And it has nothing to do with the facts. That has something that the problem is with the reasoning, with the logic behind the argument. So I started Logic Check sort of to explore that idea that instead of just fact-checking the news, because there's plenty of places to do that, try to do something unique, which is to check the arguments, to check the logic behind the news, to determine when, for example, true facts are being marshaled to support a false or at least a sort of misleading conclusion. And I think this all sort of leads to, you know, while these are not distinctly political projects, right, Logic Check, Critical Voter, these are educational projects. I was hoping that using a common shared experience of an election to teach these skills would give people something to kind of grasp onto, to learn during an election season. And there's been, you know, a lot of kind of positive feedback on them. But I think there's also been a sense of like, you know, politics is so charged. Politics is the time when it's not time to think about things. It's a time to organize into armed camps and, you know, sort of not change your mind under any circumstance. And I think in a way, one of the reasons we've sort of reached this sort of toxic brand of politics is because we haven't really thought about things for many, many years, right? And so I think it's no accident that the candidates and the campaigns we're exposed to now are primarily about playing off the flaws in our thinking, right? Playing off our tribalism, our emotional reasoning, our biases that are sort of hardwired into our system, as opposed to having arguments, debates, you know, about substantive issues where we kind of treat each other with respect, even if we are diametrically opposed. I think, you know, the disillusion of the art of argumentation and debate is one of the reasons we have ended up with politics now. That's all based on sort of emotive reasoning and kind of all the sort of oddities that take place in social media that has the sort of form of debate, but none of the substance.
Very good. Getting back a little bit to the nuts and bolts of folks actually learning the skills of critical thinking, in your book, your recent book, Critical Thinking, you make the point that teaching people basic critical thinking skills like, and then you mention, and I'll just mention a few, like media and information literacy, and we know how important that is to have those skills of checking out the information we get from the media. Recognizing the emotional and reasoning flaws, which we talk about, that lead to bias thinking, and creating argument maps is another one that you mentioned to clarify the logical structure of arguments. Now, to do that using textbook examples is one thing. But then when people really try to apply this with the information that they see coming from the real world, it's not as easy as it looks in the textbook, right? Because the real world examples, the arguments are not as well defined as they are and clearly stated. There's a lot of other language thrown in there that it makes it a little more difficult. This kind of a two-part question. I'm going to ask you first to explain briefly what argument maps are for our listeners. That'll pique their interest in doing that. And then we'll put some links up to how to deal with argument maps on our Facebook page. And the other part of that question is, how can listeners best take some of these skills that they've heard on this show, or they're coming to them in pieces, and to start to practice some of those critical thinking techniques in real life using the information that they're exposed to?
I'm glad you mentioned argument maps, because they are, there's different ways of diagramming reasoning. We talked before that, you know, what's one of the key sort of things you need to understand to be a critical thinker? Well, you need to know some form of logic, right? You don't have to know all forms of logic. You don't even need to know particularly sort of sophisticated ones. You can get by very, very well as a critical thinker with informal logic, which is one of the more straightforward methods of reasoning. But, you know, one thing about sort of informal logic is it tends to work with discrete arguments. So if you have complex arguments that might chain and branch out in multiple directions, you might need a whole series of sort of informal arguments to sort of capture the essence of that argument. The good thing about diagrammatic reasoning, Stephen Toulmin created one of the first very popular versions, Toulmin maps, but argument mapping is one that I've worked with some people very closely on that. It's particularly suitable for younger learners to pick up very, very quickly. And if people check out Logic Check, recently I had a whole series on argument maps from this organization, Thinker Analytics, that specialize in helping teachers fold argument mapping techniques into English and social studies classes. And the thing that's good about an argument map is arguments that branch out in multiple directions, which most real-world arguments do, right? That people don't sort of get up to make a political speech and say, you know, premise one, ABC, premise two, DEF, therefore G, right? You know, people make arguments that have, you know, supporting arguments within them and multiple branches. And the thing that's great about an argument map is it can capture all of that sort of complexity and allow you to sort of see what you're really arguing and analyze it adequately. You know, I think what you referred to about, you know, when arguments move from a textbook example to something in the real world, we refer to that as arguments in the wild, right? And they aren't designed to be analyzed as in a worksheet exercise, right? They are complex. They may branch in multiple directions, like I just described. They may contain rhetoric, some of which is there to increase the persuasive power of an argument, but it also, some of it might be there to deceive, right? So for those type of arguments, you need to not just understanding rules of logic or rules of argument mapping, for example. That's easy. That's one of the dirty little secrets, is you can learn, you know, how the rules of argument mapping or, you know, informal logic quite quickly. I mean, I think and Critical Voter was originally a podcast, and I taught all these skills in less than 20 hours, right? You can pick up the knowledge, but then putting into practice takes many, many hours, right? It takes years, right? Maybe not 10,000 hours worth of time, but a lot of practice, because you'll encounter one argument that is, you know, a political speech, and you get good at distilling political speech down into clear statements that can be analyzed logically. But then you see an advertisement, right? And that's using a different set of techniques, and you need to apply the same sort of skills to that, but that's going to be a different experience. And you have to make a life decision about, like, what college to go to, and on and on and on. So I think that's what takes the practice, and not just any old kind of practice, what's called deliberate practice. You know, that's a piece. That's another one of the high leverage practices, is to make sure that students are exposed to opportunities specifically designed to let them get better and better and better at not just understanding the rules of logic, but applying them to increasingly diverse situations. That's how you get good at it.
Very good. And while we're waiting for callers. Let's go to the next question.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, one of the things we like to do here on Thinking Clearly is we like to offer suggestions to our listeners about, you know, good accessible resources that they can check out, you know, between our shows, because I'm sure they're waiting patiently every month. You know, just accessible resources for people to, you know, continue to refine their critical thinking skills and practice. We're wondering, you know, do you have any suggestions for our listening audience for accessible critical thinking resources?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of good stuff out there. I mean, you know, first of all, a lot of the stuff I've done is free, like Logic Check is free. Critical Vote is a book, but many chapters of it are available for free, along with sort of curriculum materials. If anyone's interested, actually, my son is going through the process of learning to become a critical thinker. He's blogging about the experience at my Degree of Freedom website. And so one thing you could do is sort of follow along with him and tap the resources he's tapping to learn these things. You know, so those are free resources, but like a lot of people put up free resources. You mentioned Kevin DeLaPlante. He's got, again, you know, some programs that are all sort of stitched together, you know, that are not completely free, but he has a lot of material that is free. You know, his original podcast, which is how I discovered him. You know, a lot of that material is still around, and that's terrific. And then I think I've just been surprised that, you know, how many people have released sort of, particularly on YouTube, kind of content related to critical thinking, usually certain areas like fallacies or scientific reasoning. But there's a lot of good stuff out there. And also, you know, in the intro, you mentioned massive open online courses, right? MOOCs. But the very first MOOC I ever took was a free one from Duke University, actually a partnership between Duke University called Think Again, University of North Carolina, called Think Again, How to Reason and Argue. That was a terrific course, and I think that's available through Coursera for free. And if you look at sort of other MOOC sites, Coursera, edX, there's other free critical thinking courses. So I'd say if you're looking for sort of a systematic, you know, inexpensive, but something structured like a course, I'd start with the Coursera and edX free MOOC courses. If you're looking for just, you know, something to learn about, you know, rhetoric or about informal logic, you can, you know, go to sites like Logic Check or Kevin DeLaPlante sites, or just sort of Google and look for sort of free resources on those areas.
Yeah, and just for folks' reference, Kevin DeLaPlante's podcast is called The Argument Ninja. Great podcast.
And we did mention Logic Check. You do a little on argument mapping on that, I think, don't you? LogicCheck.net?
Correct, yep. There was just a series on it by this organization, Thinker Analytics, that specializes in argument mapping. We had a guest
yeah.
post from their COO.
Yeah, I've looked at that, and thank you for citing them in your book, and we're going to post that one on our Facebook page, too, and we'll post a lot of these resources on our Facebook page. And I was really kind of amused by it seemed like this project with your son, which you call Ben Learns Critical Thinking, was a result of Ben, you know, not going to school on a regular basis because of the COVID pandemic. And it sounded like a good use of time. How's that project going with Ben?
It's good. Yeah. I mean, he actually, you know, his school did get their act together quite well. So this is sort of a supplement for him, almost like an internship. But I mean, it does bring up a really good point, is that, you know, kids who their schools are less structured, or, you know, they have more free time because, you know, schools are making less demands on them. This would be an ideal time to learn to be a critical thinker, right? You know, because for one thing, you can learn to, you know, not stumble into possibly some of the same problems that have gotten us into these various messes that 2020 is all about. But then, you know, this material is out there. It's a chance to learn how to be a lifelong learner by learning how to locate resources to teach yourself to think critically. I think, you know, that, as we said before, even if you go to a very good school that is very sort of dedicated to developing students' knowledge and content knowledge, you can always do more to sort of become a critical thinker. And this is a perfect time to sort of dedicate some time and effort into that.
And I'm not sure, I don't think we have any callers yet.
Yes, we do. We've had a caller.
Well, let's welcome that caller right now. Caller, welcome to Thinking Clearly.
Thank you. I have a question about fact-checking. I don't really understand how that works. I don't know how you can decide if the facts that somebody says are facts are actually facts, unless you were really there. And then it seems to me now that there's billions of contradicting facts, and how do you know, like, who owns these places online, and where do these facts, so-called facts, come from? Anyway, I'm going to hang up and I'll take my answer. I'll listen to the radio.
Sure. No, that's a great question. I mean, I think, you know, fact, the term fact, like the term truth, is actually much more complicated than it sounds. But I think, you know, a simple term, there's some, you know, things that are straightforward facts that can be checked as true or false, right? You know, somebody made a speech, there's a recording of that speech, we can listen to the words that were said and say with certainty that certain things were or were not said. They're scientific facts, right? That objects fall down, you know, water is H2O. But in a way, those are the simplest, least controversial sort of facts. There's other facts that are open to interpretation, right? We're navigating at a time now where we're debating facts about a pandemic, you know, COVID-19, a lot of it having to do with statistics, with numbers, you know, that things are getting, you know, much, much worse, or no, things are stabilizing, but it's all based on statistical information that is open to interpretation. So you have to understand, you know, to a certain degree, understand how statistics work, how uncertainty is built into them. And that's a different sort of fact. But you also have a problem, and this is why I created Logic Check, where the facts are true, right? But they are not built into a argument that supports the conclusion, right? I could say that, you know, we've been in lockdown for 3 months, you know, since or we've been locked down for months, but, you know, coronavirus deaths have kept going up during that period. So social distancing is a failure, right? Well, you could check my facts, right? We have been locked down for months and coronavirus deaths have gone up, right? So those survive the fact checking project, right? Those are true facts. Those are statements of fact that could be checked out, but they don't support the conclusion. Why? Well, it's not because the facts are false. It's because the logic is faulty, right? That nobody told us that social distancing would end coronavirus immediately in all places everywhere, right? So it's an invalid argument. The inference that goes from the premises to the conclusion is wrong. Okay, so that's an example where, you know, the problem is not with facts. The problem is with the argument. And I think, you know, what you're talking about in terms of, or the caller talked about, in terms of, you know, who owns the facts, often it's about who owns the interpretation of the facts. You know, who gets to decide that a speech that were containing many complex arguments was all about, you know, the one piece that I picked out. You know, that's where the need to sort of really be able to understand and think critically, which includes telling, you know, obviously identifying when facts are false. But in many cases, you know, facts are true facts are marshaled to support false conclusions, which is why the sort of critical thinking project is all the more important, right? Because fact checking alone is not necessarily going to get us to the truth.
Great summary, John. And we're bumping up against the top of the hour here. That last question gives us a whole topic for a whole other hour on Thinking Clearly. That's a biggie.
Truth?
Yeah. So, Jonathan Haber, thank you very much for your work in clarifying and promoting critical thinking and for being a great guest with us on Thinking Clearly. And on our Facebook page, we're going to post links to your web pages that we've discussed and links to your Critical Voter and Logic Check and Degrees of Freedom. Is there any other real brief contact information that you'd like to air?
Got them all. I'll sort of send you any particular links that I think you're listeners would be interested in, including some things that would go further with that last question. But no, I just want to actually thank you for all you've done over the years on this project. I think, you know, one of the things I urge people, as you know, at the end of the book, is there should be a sort of critical thinking should be celebrated in the culture much more than it is. And I think shows like yours are doing very important work to get us there.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. And I want to thank our engineer, Dara Lee. And as always, thank you, Julia. And until next time, keep thinking.
Clearly.
Tell you that they have the plan, 'cause everyone's lost chin deep in the sand, and what they're trying to sell to you, you shouldn't be buying.